This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
In which the theme of the program is, no, come on, seriously, this economy's pretty good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the second day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Marketplace macroeconomic word of the day today is vibes. An explanation will be forthcoming in a matter of minutes, but to set the stage, some of the data behind said vibes. Let us start with just one example, an update from the Institute for Supply Management on U.S. manufacturing for July, which included this line. This is a quote. The prices index remained in decreasing territory at a level generally not seen since early in the coronavirus pandemic when, by the way, this is no longer a quote, you had to look really, really hard to find any inflation in this economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with the data vibe.
I like it when an economist gives me an economic zeitgeist quote right at the top.
The economy continues to expand, but inflation pressures are easing.
Thanks for doing the heavy lifting, Bill Adams, chief economist at Comerica Bank. Adams says the latest ISM report on manufacturing confirms that the pandemic-era dynamic of shortages of everything causing inflation is behind us.
Supply chains are functioning better. Consumers are spending more on experiences and less on things.
More supply, less demand.
And that's going to flow through to slower increases in manufactured goods prices or outright declines. And that's good for the Fed getting inflation back to their target.
We're seeing this inflation dynamic play out in the auto industry, says Garrett Nelson at CFRA.
With the easing of supply chains and the semiconductor shortage, auto production has increased, and that has led to an improvement in inventory levels.
New car prices are still rising, but more slowly than last year. Used car prices are actually falling. Meanwhile, a gradual slowdown in the labor market, less demand for workers by employers, is keeping a lid on pay hikes, says Frank Fiorelli at payroll and HR firm Paychex.
Wages are not accelerating anymore. You know, obviously still growing, but that growth has definitely been slowing.
Paychex just released its monthly small business employment report. It found wage growth fell below 4% in July for the first time since 2021, meaning wages are growing faster than prices and workers are gaining ground against inflation for a change. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street today could have been the credit rating downgrade, could have been some less than impressive earnings. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. My money is on the Wawas when we get there. So, vibes. You may be wondering how we got here. Back in the spring, we had Kyla Scanlon on the program. She is an economics educator. She's also an online creator. And she is the creator, in fact, of the phrase Vibe Session. And we decided it was time to get her back on the phone again because it kind of seems like the vibe has changed. Kyla, it's great to have you back on.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, the Vibe Session. I need you to, first of all, define some terms for me here. Last time we talked, we went over it a little bit. Remind people.
Yeah, so it's a temporary vibe decline, even though the economic data is doing okay. So it's when the sentiment is down, despite the fact that it seems like the economy is just humming along.
Okay, now, you have written recently, actually, and I don't remember if it was before Powell's last press conference or just after or when it was exactly, but you wrote the other day that maybe the vibe session is over.
A lot of people have been saying that. Bloomberg actually published this piece saying it was over. So I guess it is. Consumer sentiment is at all-time highs. It's such a tough question to answer. Like, are people actually feeling better? Because there's still so much improvement that has to happen. And if you go to somebody and you're like, well, things could be way worse than they are, it doesn't feel that good. But it seems like most people are feeling a lot better. Real wages are finally starting to tick up. The labor market is holding steady despite the Fed's efforts to have it maybe not be steady. So I think things are trending upwards for most people. But still, it can feel like there's sometimes maybe something missing or something a little bit off.
You know, we have all, and by we, I mean, you know, economic and business journalism and you, the observer, the trained observers out there who also do this, have been spending a lot of time the last like year and a half saying, are we in a recession? Are we not in a recession? Should we just stop doing that?
Yeah. Bank of America actually published a piece today saying like, yeah, you can just not say it. Like, you can just get over the idea that we are not in a recession and that we might not go into one. So I think that's the big thing is like, we're constantly talking about like, oh, are we going to enter a recession? Like, a recession is coming, a recession is coming. And a recession has been coming since we last had a recession. It seems like the economy is doing okay. There's a lot of stuff coming in the fall, like student loan payments starting back up. I think, you know, Fitch downgrading the United States, it's not going to cause a recession, but it's just another point that could be something to watch out for. But it seems like the economy is holding up pretty well, all things considered.
I want to get to the Fitch thing in a second, but how do you measure the vibes? What do you look at?
Oh man, I look at a lot of different things like Twitter, or I guess X, it's called now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, scrolling on X, and also in my comments section, you know, I have 500 different comments pretty much every day across all the different platforms of people telling me how they're experiencing their lives and how they're experiencing the economy. So I use that as a gauge, and then, you know, talking to friends, talking to different people in the community. So there's a lot of different indicators that you can use, but usually the general sentiment of social media, which is of course a little bit skewed, as well as going out into the real world and talking to people.
Okay, the Fitch thing. The downgrade came yesterday afternoon. There was much wailing and gnashing of teeth. Let me ask you, though, how big a deal is it really?
I don't know. It's kind of interesting. It's an interesting timing for sure. Yeah. Like, everyone's sort of like, why did you do this now, Fitch? It seems a little political, which of course everything is political at the end of the day. But I think for Fitch, you know, they were pointing to the debt ceiling. They warned about this. They were like, if you all don't get it together over the debt ceiling, you're going to get downgraded. And of course, the United States sort of got it together over the debt ceiling, but that's still an issue. I think they're worried about, you know, they listed expected fiscal deterioration. It seems like the Fitch director talked about, you know, the January 6th issue, just the polarization in the United States, and just worries over whether or not the two political parties will be able to reconcile.
Right. But we should also say here, it's not a reflection of the state of this economy, just to get back to the vibe session, right? I mean, the economy is good and strong, and Fitch is specifically not saying that it's about the economy.
No, they're saying, it's about the financing of the economy, the future financing of the economy, and whether or not it will be able to continue. So the economy right now is strong, but Fitch pointed to, you know, skewed demographics. So like Medicare, Social Security, just being able to finance that. But all of that is very much far down the line. The medium-term fiscal framework is something that they listed. So I think it's like the future of the United States, but the economy right now is sound, and presumably it'll be sound in a few years. It seems like most things get figured out over time.
Kyla Scanlon, she is an author, an educator, a creator. You should follow her on all the socials. I think it's, at Kyla Scan, right?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
At Kyla Scan. And also we'll get the book plug in here. It's coming out soonish. I don't know when. It's called In This Economy. Kyla, thanks a bunch. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, thank you.
Human voice recognition is one of the big challenges of modern technology. Too many of us just talk too differently to make it simple. And that gets me to this. Google is making some changes to Google Assistant, the company's voice-enabled virtual helper. Think Apple's Siri or Amazon's, you know, the one that's on your kitchen counter that if I say the name, it'll go off and you'll be angry with me. Anyway, Google is bringing in some AI people to quote-unquote supercharge Google Assistant with the same technology that underlies ChatGPT in the hopes of making them just understand us better. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
There's a new AI assistant on the block called Pi. I reluctantly gave it access to my iPhone mic to test it out. Pi, would you ever hang out with Siri?
That's a funny question. The thing is, since we're computer programs, we can't really hang out in the physical sense of the word. But I'm sure we can chat with each other via our respective platforms and perhaps learn from each other.
Even with that laugh, Pi is pretty impressive, and it's not the only AI tool that wants to chat you up. Arvind Srinivas is the founder of Perplexity AI, a search engine he hopes will be able to talk back to users soon.
That's the experience we want to bring to search, like where you can just literally ask the computer questions that you would ask a human.
Startups like Perplexity may be at a disadvantage to the Googles and Amazons of the world that own the phones and smart speakers already in our pockets and living rooms. Brett Greenstein at the consulting firm PwC says he can see a day soon where even hotel rooms have voice-enabled AI assistants. He says more capabilities will bring more privacy concerns.
I don't really ask for anything very personal in a current assistant, but that will increasingly be true when it can be more helpful to me.
So, how does Siri feel about all this?
Hey, Siri, what do you think of Pi, the AI assistant?
I don't have an answer for that. Is there something else I can help with?
You know what, Siri, there's something about you I actually prefer.
Siri knows many things.
Wonder if she knows what's coming. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
You don't have to be Siri or use her to know what I'm going to say next. Coming up.
Honestly, I wouldn't have worked as hard for scholarships.
Do not tell that to your college counselor. But first, let's do the numbers. Told ya. I don't get to decide, but I just know sometimes. Dow Industrials, down 348 points today, about 1%, 35,282. NASDAQ fell 310 points, about 2.2% there, finished at 13,973. The S&P 500 declined 63 points, that is 1.4%, ended at 45-13. It has been a good long while since we've had the Wawas. Anyway, Kyla mentioned this. Bank of America has decided, no, we're not going to have a recession after all. Bank economists noted that wages and prices are moving in the right direction, which is to say down, and cited good economic growth and low unemployment. Ford sold nearly 6% more vehicles in July than the same month a year ago. That despite a slump in delivery of EVs. Shares dropped 2.8% today. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note. Here you go, 4.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. Listen up, people. We've got one last chance to double your impact when you donate during this May fundraiser. It's Match Monday, and the Investors Challenge Fund is matching donations today only up to $25,000. We need to put every single dollar of these funds to use for our newsroom in the months ahead so we can keep you and people across this country informed. Please give right now and generously at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We talk a lot on this program about the Federal Reserve and its job setting interest rates in this economy. Every now and then, like during the spate of regional bank failures this past spring, we talk about the Fed's job as a regulator of said banks. The central bank is also, though, a payments manager, handling more than $5 trillion worth of payments that banks make every single day. A couple of weeks ago, the Fed launched a new payment service. It's called FedNow, and it's meant ideally to modernize the payment system in this country by letting people send and receive money instantly instead of having to wait 2 or 3 days for things to clear. But if you want to use the Fed's new service, your bank has to sign up, and so far, only a couple of dozen of them have. So Marketplace's Justin Ho asked a couple of bankers how they are thinking about FedNow.
Banks know that their customers want to move money around instantly, just like an email or a text message.
And so we need to be able to compete and offer those products.
That's Robert James II, CEO of Carver Financial Corporation, a company with community banks in Alabama and Georgia. He says many mobile payment apps offer their own instant payment options, and that's raised the standard for money transfers.
There's just an expectation that you can access money instantaneously.
The Federal Reserve says its system is much broader than a person-to-person payment app. Customers at a bank with FedNow could pay bills at the last minute. Businesses could receive payments instantly and then turn around and spend the money. Workers could get their paychecks faster.
People who are looking for you to pay them are expecting their money immediately, not with a lag that comes from either writing a check or sending it through some sort of a system that requires a 2 or 3 day hold.
Thing is, James says his banks are not signing up for the Fed's instant payment service yet. One reason is that small banks like his often don't have the staff and resources to manage new technology. That means they have to pay for third-party companies to get it up and running.
And so every time we add a new system or feature, it ends up costing the bank and it makes our overhead higher.
Adding a new payment system also requires employee training, new customer policies, an updated website.
There's a lot of moving parts, even beyond just connecting to the technology.
That's Lance Noggle with the Independent Community Bankers of America. He says banks would also need to come up with new customer protection measures to prevent people from accidentally sending instant payments to the wrong person or to scammers.
It's not like a check where if I sent a check to somebody, I'm like, man, I really shouldn't have sent that check. I can call the bank and do a stop payment. Once money is sent through an instant payment network, it's gone.
The Federal Reserve isn't exactly blazing a trail here. A separate instant payment network, called Real-Time Payments, has been around for more than 5 years. It's operated by the Clearing House, a company owned by several big banks. Julie Hill is a professor at the University of Alabama.
I think that there are lots of community banks who were understandably concerned about relying on a service that's provided by their competitors.
But in the last year, the Clearinghouse says the number of banks using its service has picked up. Jim Colasano runs the Clearinghouse's instant payment network. He says that's likely because the Fed has stepped in with its own service.
By having both of us in market now, we do feel that we're going to start to see some real uplift in customers and banks using instant payments, and that's going to benefit both.
One reason is that banks might be more comfortable offering instant payments in general now that the Federal Reserve is giving them another option. Says David Reiling, CEO of Sunrise Banks in Minnesota.
Because it does add that extra layer of competition in regards to features, benefits, improvements to the system over time.
Reiling says banks like his have an existing relationship with the Federal Reserve. So if banks sign up for FedNow, the hope is that the Fed will listen to its member banks.
And we'll take that very seriously as to what improvements need to be made or what alterations are, you know, at the top of the list and what's at the bottom.
Reiling says his bank is signing up for instant payment services from both the Clearinghouse and the Federal Reserve. That way, he can see which one he likes more. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
It's rare that there's a crossover story on this program featuring superconductors and business models, but that's where we find ourselves today. Researchers in Korea have made an extraordinary claim that they have developed a superconductor that works at room temperatures and pressures, and it has drawn a lot of attention. Also, though, skepticism, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishul reports.
A room temperature superconductor levitates on magnets, transmits electricity with no resistance. It would be revolutionary. Think levitating trains, fusion reactors, significantly more efficient power grids. Korean researchers Suk Bae-Lee, Ji-hoon Kim, and Young-won Kwon say they've made one by combining copper and a mineral known as lead apatite.
I think it's a long shot because many extraordinary claims do not pan out.
Doug Nadelson is a professor of physics at Rice University. He has concerns about the underlying data. There have been at least two claims just this year to have found new superconducting materials. One of those was recently retracted. The other requires high pressure to work.
Over the years, there have been a lot of what we call USOs, which means unidentified superconducting objects.
Michael Norman is with Argonne National Lab. The recipe to make LK99 is pretty easy, at least by scientific lab standards. So chemists around the world are trying.
We have people with the lab who've grown samples, and they're measuring them, and we'll see what they find.
So far, he says, no floating rocks. Richard Green is a physicist at University of Maryland.
I expect that there will be a room temperature superconductor sometime in the next 30 years.
With so many scientists racing to replicate LK99, he says we should know in a few weeks whether this is finally it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We're just a week or two away from fall semester. We're talking college here, which means that right around, now, tuition bills are rolling in. Paying for college can be complicated, of course, but some students do win private scholarships from companies maybe or foundations that those students expect to be able to put toward those bills. Except, if they are getting money from school, sometimes schools will take a look at that private scholarship money and deduct the amount from its institutional grant, referred to by some in higher education as the August surprise. More formally, it's known as scholarship displacement. It's hard to know how many students get surprised like that, but some states are passing laws to end it. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Emily Liang got in the habit of applying for things pretty early in life. She grew up in Oakland, California, and both her parents are originally from China. They don't speak English, and she remembers helping her mom fill out an application for a food services job back in middle school.
I remember, writing her resume for her.
Her mom got the job, and in high school, Liang started filling out her own applications for scholarships to help her pay for college.
I had an ongoing Excel sheet of just, all the different scholarships that I could apply to.
She says she got a couple big national ones, a handful of smaller local ones, and a generous financial aid package from Stanford, where she decided to enroll in 2020. Part of the financial aid calculus for students includes a portion they're expected to contribute themselves, which they can earn by working. At Stanford, that's usually at least $5,000 per year.
I remember asking financial aid whether I could use my outside scholarships to cover that, and they said no, that would just eat up my Stanford scholarship. It wouldn't necessarily be applied to that.
In other words, the private money would have displaced part of what Stanford was offering her. Liang says as a first-generation college student from a low-income family, this was really frustrating.
If your end goal is to support students, they should have that financial freedom on how to use their money.
A number of elected officials feel the same way. At least six states have laws limiting or banning scholarship displacement, including California, which passed its law last fall. Stanford says that students can use outside scholarships to pay their contribution, but it and other colleges still have to adhere to federal regulations that say colleges can't give students more financial aid than they actually need to attend. Lo Klink works in financial aid at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
There are some students who have really robust financial aid offers or really large scholarships where that need figure is met and then something needs to be reduced.
So if a private scholarship puts a student over the top, then the school may reduce its institutional grant. Clink says that goes back into a pool of money to be reallocated to other students.
It can allow an institution, particularly under-resourced institutions, to spread their wealth even further.
Even so, this practice of denying institutional aid when a student's awarded outside grants isn't what private scholarship providers had in mind. Calwis Lowe works for Scholarship America, which awards its own funds and distributes grants on behalf of foundations and companies.
The reason why they're doing this is because they want an educated and skilled workforce that they can draw from, hire from.
The private sector gave out $12 billion in scholarships to undergrads in the school year ending in 2022. That's according to an estimate from the College Board. And companies want that money to work for them.
We have so many corporations who talk about having issues finding the right type of diverse staff. So this is, you know, partly around charity, but also it's an investment.
Lowe says scholarship displacement could discourage donors from offering money in the first place. It would also have discouraged Stanford senior Emily Liang, who says if she'd known about scholarship displacement sooner.
Honestly, I wouldn't have worked as hard for scholarships.
Which also means, she says, she wouldn't have received the mentoring and networks that came with them. She also wishes that schools and scholarship providers would take into account all the costs students incur, along with tuition and housing.
What's not covered is dental expenses, medical expenses, like a flight going back home because your parents are sick.
She points out these are costs that all students have, and if they earn scholarships, they should be able to use that money for whatever they need. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Stephanie's story was a collaboration with the Hechinger Report. That's a nonprofit that covers education. This final note on the way out today, it's kind of good news, bad news. I saw this on Bloomberg. The good news is that according to a whole mess of data from a workplace analytics company called ActiveTrack, the average workday has shrunk by 37 minutes in the past year, and fewer people are pulling overtime shifts as well. Here, though, is the thing. The company says productivity has not gone down, which means we're being more efficient, or put another way, we are doing the same amount of work we used to do in less time. All right, we're going. Here is your moment of economic context, a sneak preview of sorts of the July jobs report we're going to get on Friday morning. ADP, which is the private payroll processing company we talk about every now and then, and it has oodles of data. It said this morning it is figuring this economy added 324,000 jobs last month. To be clear, the official jobs number and ADP don't always line up, but sometimes they're pretty close. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Jessen Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.